Vivaldi's Flute Concerto, Opus 10, Number 4, played by Wissam Bustani with a string ensemble. And that's about it for this edition of Sunday Morning. I'm so glad you were able to join me, and I do hope you've enjoyed listening. Next week, my symphonic rarity is a very attractive work by Hans Gall, a new recording of his first symphony. And between 10 and 11, you can enjoy the company of musical puppets and dolls. So please do join me same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this week by Neil Miners.
What, if anything, links early music to the music of our own times? One answer is the Hilliard Ensemble. This is the group who've sung plenty of Thomas Tallis, but sound just as at home with the music of Arvo Pärt or the saxophone of Jan Garbarek. This remarkable male voice quartet celebrate their 40th anniversary this year. And today, the Early Music Show joins the party. I'll be meeting the Hilliards, and they'll be choosing their favourite recordings spanning some seven centuries of repertoire. And I'll be asking them why the group's 40th year is also its last. Join the Hilliard Ensemble for this week's Early Music Show, this afternoon at 2, here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, that should certainly be well worth hearing. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 1 minute past midday, and next Private Passions. And Michael Barclay's guest is the Deputy President of the Supreme Court, Lady Brenda Hale.
My guest today must be used to finding herself again and again the only woman in the room. 30 years ago, she was the first to be appointed to the Law Commission and the youngest person there. 10 years ago, she was the first female judge to be appointed to the Appellate Committee of the House of Lords as Baroness Hale of Richmond. And there hasn't been another woman since. Last year, she was appointed as the Deputy President of the Supreme Court, where she's still the only woman. Her judgments have changed family and equality law in this country, and she remains outspoken about domestic violence, women in prison, and the rights of children. Lady Hale, you've been described as a trailblazer, which you clearly are from what we've heard, but also as a troublemaker sometimes. Are you someone who quite likes to stir things up a bit, especially among the male establishment?
No, I don't think I am. I don't set out to stir anything up. I see things as I see them, and sometimes I say so. But I certainly don't set out to upset anybody.
But there are little sort of things like old-fashioned habits in clubs where the men stay behind for their port and cigars. You got a bit fed up with that, didn't you?
Yes, it happened in judges' lodgings at formal dinners. And one felt as a woman judge that one was nevertheless being treated as a different sort of person from the men judges. And we weren't. We were the same. We were their equals. So why were we being expected to be segregated from them?
I'm interested in where this determination and ambition, which I think is lifelong, might have come from. You grew up in the 50s in Richmond in Yorkshire. And, I mean, I know many other people from Yorkshire. They're always very direct and plain-spoken.
Well, I suppose you can take the lass out of Yorkshire, but you can't take Yorkshire out of the lass, as they say. But I think I owe it more to a very loving, supportive family of teachers who believed in education, who believed in their daughters. They had three daughters. It would not have occurred to my parents to treat us differently because we were daughters rather than sons.
And encourage self-expression and curiosity.
Well, there was a lot of chat. Meals were not quiet things where you got on with eating.
Your first choice of music is a very famous piece, and it takes you back to Yorkshire, and I suspect your parents too.
Well, yes, it does. It's Kathleen Ferrier. They were great admirers of hers, and this Blow the Wind Southerly is a song from the northeast. It's about the sea and a sailor, and it, yes, takes me back to Yorkshire.
Blow the wind. southerly, southerly, blow, bonny breeze, my lover, to me. They told me last night there were ships in the offing, and I hurried down to the deep rolling sea. But my eye could not see it, wherever might be it, the bark that is bearing my lover to me. Blow the wind southerly, 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 blow, bonny breeze, o'er the bonny blue sea. Blow the wind southerly, 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 blow, bonny breeze, and bring him to me. Is it not sweet to hear the breeze singing, as lightly it comes o'er the deep rolling sea? But sweeter and dearer by far 'tis when bringing the bark of my true love in safety.
Kathleen Ferrier singing Blow the Wind Southerly, recorded in 1949, and you would have been a little girl.
Four.
You obviously loved law from quite an early start, Lady Hill, because you left Girton College with a pretty rare start first. And this must have been a time when there weren't that many women at Cambridge, and even fewer law students, I imagine.
Well, I think there were five or six women in my year reading law. And there were over 100 men, which was roughly the same ratio as when I became a High Court judge, which was deeply unfair to the many, many brainy women around the place who didn't have the same opportunity.
The next music is from one of the operas you love. It's Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier.
Because I first learnt to love Richard Strauss when I was at Cambridge, revising for my Tripos examinations. And I used to march around my room at Girton, reciting my notes to myself to two pieces of music. And one of them was Ein Heldenleben. And that taught me to love Strauss. But it wasn't until much later that I actually went and saw Der Rosenkavalier in the flesh.
And it has that extraordinary yearning quality, doesn't it? Because it's not only about love, but it's about the loss of love and the reluctant acceptance of that loss.
Yes. The trio in which she gives her lover up to the younger woman is the most remarkable act of generosity, because she does it so freely and she does it so immediately when she realises the situation.
I think a quality that distinguishes this trio is a wonderful kind of mix of three women's voices, almost sort of bouncing and sliding off each other in a way which is ecstatic, not to say erotic.
Yes, yes. Well, the whole opera is very erotic, and they meld so amazingly.
Thank you.
Well, it's gut-wrenching, really, isn't it?
Extraordinary, don't you think, Lady Hale, that Strauss should have decided to continue that tradition of trouser roles, so that all of the characters, even the males, are sung by women. But one can see why he did when one hears those voices.
Well, that particular.
Yes, in that particular instance. René Fleming, Barbara Bonney and Susan Graham singing the trio from the end of Strauss's opera Der Rosenkavalier. Christoph Eschenbach was conducting the Vienna Philharmonic. Well, here's an interesting question arising from that. I suppose we think, and you aspire as a judge, to be reasonably cool, rational, clear thinking. And yet from the music you've chosen, there's clearly a very emotional side to this particular judge.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is it difficult to square the two sometimes?
No, I think it's easier if you recognise that you have emotions and you try and understand your emotional reaction to a case as well as your logical, rational, legal reaction to the case.
Well, I mean, one example springs to my mind of that is that even though in the case of the women that wanted to take the Prime Minister to court over Iraq, people who'd lost loved ones, was that although the judgment went against them, and you concurred with that, you did feel you wanted to express your compassion and sympathy for them.
Yes, that was the particular case about the mothers of soldiers who had been killed in Iraq. And by the time the case got to us, the issue was whether the government had taken enough care to find out whether going to war in Iraq was lawful in international law terms. That's how it became. And I said that I understood entirely why the mothers of these soldiers would want to know that if our government was putting soldiers in harm's way, they were doing so in a just and lawful cause.
So did you conclude that it was a just war then?
No, because the whole issue was whether Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is the right to life, required the government to hold an inquiry into whether there had been a sufficient cause for the war.
Because that's what they wanted, was an inquiry.
That is what they wanted, and we had to say, no, that isn't part of what Article 2 requires.
So there must be many occasions when you feel that the appellant, for want of a better term, must feel confounded, because emotionally they are in many ways in the right, but legally they're in the wrong.
Well, there are obviously cases, and we deal only with pure points of law. There are cases where the law leads to a conclusion which seems very harsh in the individual case. But on the other hand, one has to look at the bigger picture and what is just overall and what will do the greatest justice to the greatest number of people.
We've been talking about the balance between emotion and reason. And our next composer, Bach, marries the two in a most extraordinary way.
I think he is the lawyer amongst composers. The mixture of emotion, amazing tunes, but the complexity of the way in which he puts it all together.
So the arguments have almost a sort of legal thoroughness.
Well, they do. What I have chosen is his Mass in B minor. One of the reasons for that is that I do love church music.
Which movement from the Bach Mass in B minor have you chosen?
The Gloria.
Why?
Well, it is the most fantastic tune. Very, very uplifting. And I think one needs to be a bit uplifted from time to time. This, too, is the sort of thing to march around the room to, isn't it? But I didn't know it when I was a student at Cambridge. Otherwise, I would have done.
Oh,
It's glorious, isn't it? And there's an almost dancing lilt to that music. John Elliott Gardner conducting the English Baroque soloists in the opening of the Gloria from Bach's Mass in B minor. You love the Mass form, don't you? Of course, it does give a structure to a service.
Yes. Well, I grew up, of course, in the Church of England in the north of England, where the weekly service was Matins. Now the only way I get to Matins is to go to Gray's Inn Chapel, which I do from time to time during term time. And mostly the service is a Eucharist, at which, of course, we always have a Gloria. But rather a lot of the Glorias in English church music are a bit gloomy, which is why I so love that, because Gloria shouldn't be gloomy. It should be glorious, as you say.
And your father was a lay preacher, so your parents were both quite religious.
Yes, they didn't wear it on their sleeve, but it was a part of life, yes.
We're going to move on to an opera that takes us directly to your job, and that's Beethoven's Fidelio, which is an extraordinary piece about imprisonment, mental imprisonment, and what it's like to taste freedom.
Oh, the thing about Fidelio is injustice. It's a fight against autocracy, arbitrary power, unjust imprisonment. Right triumphs in the end, so that's good. But that's what's so powerful about it.
There are two transcending moments, I think. There's the prisoners coming into the light, yes. Which is very famous. Mm. But there's also this quartet, Mir ist so wunderbar. Mm. Mm. I feel so full of wonder. Perhaps you'd care, Lady Hale, to set the scene for us.
That's quite complicated and difficult. But you have a young woman who is in love with Fidelio. Fidelio, of course, is herself a woman, married to the prisoner that she is coming to try and rescue, so is dismayed to realise that Marcellina loves her. We have Rocco, who is Marcellina's father, who is a great admirer of Fidelio and would like Fidelio to marry his daughter. And then we have poor Gioacchino, who is in love with Marcellina.
So lots of people singing about love, about that quality of being alive that love brings in an extraordinary quartet.
Well, yes, and they're all singing past one another because they're all thinking something completely different.
Mir ist so wunderbar. I am filled with wonder, the Act One quartet from Beethoven's Fidelio. And we heard Edith Matiss, Gwyneth Jones, Franz Krass and Peter Schreier. Karl Böhm, who's conducting the Staatskapelle Dresden. And by the way, all the details of today's recordings are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You've spoken about prisoners yourself, and particularly about women in prison with mental illness. And there's been a sharp increase, Lady Hilton, in the number of women imprisoned since the 1960s. And of course, it's not always the best place for them, especially people who have mental problems.
There has been a sharp increase. Some of that, of course, is because women are committing more crimes. And those who do commit crimes are more often being prosecuted. But it is undoubtedly the case that the proportion of women who are in prison who have serious mental problems, serious addiction problems, have been the subject of serious sexual or other violence is high, and higher than the proportion of men, although it's also quite high for men. The other problems with women in prison is that they very often have children, and it's going to be very difficult for the children. It's very difficult for them to be separated from the children. Because there are comparatively few women in prison, there are fewer prisons, and they are therefore likely to be imprisoned further away from home. And it is not guaranteed that the facilities in the prison will be appropriate for them. Prison has basically been designed for men.
Are you arguing, then, that we should quite simply treat women differently from men?
I think those men for whom those problems also arise should be treated in a similar way. But study after study has suggested that what we need for women is alternatives to prison. And if they have to be sent to prison, smaller units closer to the centres of population where they come from, where they can therefore retain the links with their communities. I heard a shocking thing when we were discussing this subject at a conference recently, which is that very often when a man is released from prison, not invariably, but very often, if he is a man who has a family, there will be a reception committee when he comes out of prison. They will have come to get him. Very rarely has anybody come to get a woman when she's released from prison. It leads to so much loss.
That is interesting. You wouldn't say, of course, that there aren't any wicked women.
I mean, absolutely not. No, that's not the point at all. Nor would I say that you don't prosecute just because it's a woman, or that you regard women's excuses differently from men's excuses. Of course I wouldn't.
We have another opera, rather wonderfully, where we can connect to your career. It's Britten's Billy Budd. An extraordinary opera because he gets away with an all-male cast. I mean, when you think of the great beauty of opera, we've just heard three women singing, and now we're going to hear only men. But because of the brilliance of the composition, you never notice it. In this final scene of Billy Budd, the innocent Billy has been wrongly accused of mutiny, really, hasn't he, by Claggart, the master at arms. And Captain Vere, who is clearly a humanist in some ways, and perhaps a Britain-like character, has to sent him to his execution. Was it the sense of injustice that you particularly were attracted to here?
Well, yes. That's one of the reasons for choosing it. But the injustice is quite a subtle one. Claggart accuses Billy of fomenting mutiny because Claggart is an evil man who recognises that Billy is a very good man.
And Britten has this kind of obsession with corrupting innocence, doesn't he?
He does. So Claggart accuses Billy of this by what I think is a bit of a plot device. Billy happens to have a stammer, and so he cannot defend himself against this accusation, and in frustration lashes out and hits Claggart, and Claggart is killed. And that is what, of course, Billy is sentenced for. Captain Vere witnessed this, and therefore he knows that Billy was severely provoked. Should provocation be a defence to murder, or at least reduce the severity of the penalty? We did eventually decide that it was. But that's the moral dilemma that is keeping Captain Vere really in agony, I think.
Saved him. He knew it. Even his shipmates knew it. Though earthly nor silent then.
Well, that is an old man who is still haunted by the fact that an injustice was done all those years ago.
And the opera both opens and, as there, closes, doesn't it, with him recalling those days.
That's right.
The ending of Britain's opera, Billy Budd. Philip Langridge as Captain Vere, and we also heard Alan Opie as the First Lieutenant, Simon Keenly side as Billy Budd. Richard Hickox was conducting the London Symphony Orchestra and chorus. I wonder, Lady Hale, whether there are sometimes cases that just haunt you as well.
There are, undoubtedly, but I'm not sure that there are any that I could actually talk about just now.
Do you find sometimes being a judge quite a lonely occupation? Because it's not like a barrister where you work in a team.
The lonely one is being a trial judge when you're dealing with civil and family cases and you are hearing the witnesses, deciding where the truth lies, applying the law, and it's often a discretionary law, so working out what the right answer is going to be, and then explaining it in such a way, especially in a family case, that you hope that the parties will think that, even if they don't like the result, they know why you've done it.
So these cases can sometimes weigh quite heavily on you.
The trial judging in the family division is a very onerous job.
Well, to relieve that pressure, you've chosen a carol and you've, I think, brought along your own recording, a rather treasured cassette. Mm. And there's a family connection with it.
Yes, this is one of the carols sung every year at the Christmas concert at St Paul's Girls' School, written by John Gardner, who was a music director there. My daughter was a pupil at the school, and every year we used to go along to the carol concert and hear them sing this. It's something that they start, the whole school sings it, and it is something that they start learning right from the word go. Because the Gardner carols, as the music director who was there when my daughter was there said, have their potential for disaster.
Yes.
Well, you can see the capacity for disaster, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Tomorrow shall be my dancing day. St Paul's Girls' School, singing John Gardner's setting of the traditional carol. It's an unusual telling of the Christian story in which Jesus' life is seen as a dance. So a joyfulness there, as with the Bach, don't you think, Lady Hale?
Yeah, absolutely.
It was your first husband, who I think, who introduced you to much of the music. Sadly, that ended in divorce, but you've been very influential in trying to change the law on divorce. Would you quite like to see a total overhaul of the whole system?
Yes, but the way our world works, total overhauls don't quite happen.
In fact, rather than making it easier, I think you'd like there to be a bit of a cooling-off period.
This was what we recommended, that instead of being able to make an allegation which in practice is never defended and get a divorce in a matter of a few months or even weeks, you should start with a declaration of your belief that the marriage has irretrievably broken down and then have a cooling-off period of a year, we thought it should be, during which time you would have the space to work out what the arrangements would be if you went through with it, so that you would know what was going to happen with the children, what was going to happen with the home, what everybody was going to have to live on, and so on, before you were actually finally divorced.
Well, now an opera about marriage, power in marriage, and of course how it can be abused. Why have you chosen it?
Possibly for that reason. For all of those reasons. I ask myself, which is my favourite opera? And it has to be a choice between Billy Budd and The Marriage of Figaro. I think in the end it has to be The Marriage of Figaro because it has so much to it. But of course it is, this can't be said of all Mozart's operas, but it is an opera in which the women triumph.
Well, this is the moment where the Count repents of his womanising and begs forgiveness from his wife.
Yes. One doesn't really feel that the Count is truly going to maintain his repentance. But he has at last acknowledged that he has been caught out and that he'd better say sorry.
Mia madre, Madonna, come verrà?
and they all lived happily ever after.
I love the way he speeds it up, just that final, sort of almost Shakespearean, rather like Puck at the end of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Let's pull everything together. The ending of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, in the recording by Riccardo Muti with the Vienna Philharmonic. Cast, including Thomas Allen as Figaro, Jorma Hunninen as the Count, and Margaret Price as the Countess. The Count promising to reform. Given your experience, do you think people are capable of change?
That's a very hard question, isn't it? I hope that we're all capable of change. I think I've changed over the course of my life in some respects, not in all of them. And if I can do it, well, no doubt others can too.
So you're optimistic about human nature, even given some of the things, the terrible things you've seen?
Yes, but I think I'm generally an optimist. But one of the things that you learn from doing family cases is some of the really terrible things that people do to one another. Very, very terrible things. But the great power of both love, particularly within families, and family feeling, which is enormous in all kinds of families.
Well, of course, the difference between the end of the Mozart and the end of the Briton is that one ends with the feeling of redemption, which may be what tilted you slightly in that direction.
Yes, that could be the case, yes.
Well, talking of families, we're going to go back, really, almost to the beginning, because Paris' anthem, I Was Glad, is something I'm sure you've known for many years.
Well, I'm fairly sure that I first heard it in the first television that I watched in my life, which was the coronation of Her Majesty the Queen. We all went down to visit my grandmother in Sheffield, and she had a television, a tiny little screen, and we watched all day, and amazing and wonderful as it was. So it does go back a long time, but the last time I heard it was at the memorial service for Lord Bingham, undoubtedly the greatest judge of the last few decades. There are many other ways in which he was remarkable too.
We're going to hear the Westminster Abbey Choir, which of course is where you heard that memorial service performance, to remind you not only of the piece but the beauty of the Abbey, and indeed to remind listeners that you can drop in for services, as anybody can, four every day, five on Sundays. So on that note, Lady Hale, thank you so much for sharing your private passions with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The opening of Parry's I Was Glad, performed by the Choir of Westminster Abbey, conducted by Martin Neary, with Ian Simcock at the organ. Michael Barclay's guest in Private Passions was the Deputy President of the Supreme Court, Lady Brenda Hale. The programme was produced by Elizabeth Burke for Loftus, and you can download the programme and many more by going to the podcasts page on the BBC Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest will be the businesswoman, Emma Bridgewater.
The A-List on In Tune.
How often do you let your hair down with Fats Waller and things like that?
You should be here, you know, like the people listening at home. I don't really have much hair.
We're going to do this rocking chair, which was made popular by Louis Armstrong here, because if it wasn't for Louis Armstrong, we'd all still be wearing powdered wigs.
Have you met, you two? He's the guy who put up the sales of oboes, you know, when he won BBC Young Musician of the Year. The sales of oboes shot up overnight.
How did you get that flame lit?
Oh, the music. It's simple. It all comes out of the music.
We got a little number out, first of all.
You don't know what it is.
No, I was looking, actually, at the BBC singers. I was about to say Nigel Kennedy plays Blow Away in the Morning Dew.
The A-List on In Tune.
Weekdays at 4:30 with me, Sean Rafferty.
And me, Susie Klein.
Here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, a very good Sunday afternoon from me, John Shea. In a couple of minutes, the pianist Jonathan Biss plays Beethoven and Janáček in our lunchtime recital. And then at 2 o'clock, we're marking the 40th anniversary of the Hilliard Ensemble in the Early Music Show. Now, though, it's a minute after 1 o'clock, and here's the latest news. Tens of thousands of voters are taking part in unofficial referendums organised by pro-Russian militants in eastern Ukraine, asking people whether they support local declarations of independence. Here, the Foreign Office has described the polls in the provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk as regrettable. David Cameron has insisted that the coalition works well, brushing aside any accusations of a rift after Liberal Democrat sources described the Education Secretary Michael Gove as a zealot. They claimed 30,000 school places were being lost because the money to fund them had been diverted to what they called Mr. Gove's pet project of free schools. Mr. Gove's office has disputed the claims. A senior Roman Catholic archbishop has said that Nigerians feel a sense of national shame over the plight of more than 200 schoolgirls seized by the Islamic group Boko Haram. Cardinal John Onyekan of Abuja fears that the girls have been drugged and forced to keep moving location. British troops have withdrawn from their last outpost in southern Afghanistan, a small listening base located on a hilltop. At the peak of the operation, there were 137 bases. The only British personnel still in Afghanistan are now at Camp Bastion and will leave later this year. Four men have been arrested following the death of a 20-year-old man in Norfolk. Police were called to a disturbance at a house in Hemsby near Great Yarmouth late last night. A BBC local radio presenter has lost his job after playing a song on his Golden Oldies show which contained a racist word. David Lowe says he made an innocent mistake when he played the 1930s version of The Sun Has Got His Hat On. The BBC offered to give him back his job, but he turned it down because of a stress-related condition. The Queen's Baton is due to arrive back in the British Isles to begin the final leg of its round-the-world journey in the run-up to the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow. It'll have covered almost 120,000 miles by the time of the opening ceremony in July. And the weather, a mixture of sunny spells and showers in all areas. The best of the sunshine will be across southwestern parts of England and Wales. And that's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 3:30 past one. So, following the early music show at 2 o'clock, another chance to hear last Wednesday's choral evensong from Tewkesbury Abbey. That's at 3 o'clock. And then at 4 o'clock, the composer Jonathan Dove will be among Sarah Moore Peach's guests on this week's edition of The Choir. But now it's time for the lunchtime concert and another chance to hear last Monday's concert from the Wigmore Hall in London. It's presented by Sarah Moore Peach.
Jonathan Biss, the pianist and former Radio 3 New Generation artist, has had Beethoven's piano sonatas in his blood and his fingertips since he was a child. He's recorded them, written about them, and even taught them online. More on that later. Well, today he's playing the early and light-hearted sonata Opus 10 No. 2 and the heroic Waldstein, and between them, a selection of miniatures from Janáček's poignant cycle On an Overgrown Path. Jonathan Biss is going to start with Beethoven's 6th piano sonata, Opus 10, number 2 in F major. It's the middle of a set of 3 sonatas which he dedicated to his friend, the Countess Anna Margareta von Braun. It's in 3 movements, witty and fizzy, the last of them a sort of fugue, and it's one of Beethoven's shortest sonatas. To play Beethoven, Opus 10, number 2, here's the pianist, Jonathan Biss.